The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. It's been a busy weekend. The nice thing about having a radio show to do after a busy weekend of travel is that you don't have to look at me. You don't have to see how tired I might look. Actually, I'm not that tired. I'm excited about this week's lineup, all the programs that we have scheduled. There's been so much going on in the world today. We're going to be talking a little bit later about the German elections. You may have seen news, too, from the protest Friday night there in Chicago that ended up canceling a rally for Donald Trump. And then also there's been quite a bit more in the news over here, in particular on Brexit, the referendum scheduled for June regarding Britain's membership in the EU. And then last week, too, we didn't have time really to comment much on this article in The Atlantic, an interview with President Obama, one of his favored reporters, Jeffrey Goldberg, a huge article, I think 19,000 words in total, but a pretty revealing article as well. And there's been quite a large number of people responding to it all over the world. Lots of reaction to this piece that was in The Atlantic. But I'd like to start today just with what the Wall Street Journal calls an average terror Sunday. That would be yesterday. It says here, a few days go by now without at least one mass casualty terrorist attack somewhere in the world. Two such attacks on Sunday in the Ivory Coast and Turkey killed 39 people combined. I think the number's up to about 50 now. 50 people in two separate attacks, it says, left unchecked in the Middle East, and Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have expanded into Africa. An Islamist crescent stretches from the Horn of Africa to West Africa. And to compete for recruits, Africa's Al-Qaeda and ISIS affiliates are racing to outdo each other in savagery. Here are these terrorist groups competing for recruits. And there's one savage act after another. It's hard to keep up with. And in fact, as the Wall Street Journal brings out there with its title, it's just becoming routine. I mean, this is an average Sunday. One attack in the Ivory Coast, another attack in Turkey. Turkey, of course, is in the midst of these negotiations with Europe, with Germany, to try to get some kind of a deal that would control the flow of all these migrants. But coming back to the spread of radical Islam, let me take you back to what we wrote in The Trumpet, 1992. This is almost, 24 years ago. My father said it looks very much like the end-time king of the South will rule the radical Islamists. Iran is a natural leader, he wrote, for many of them today. Iran also has a goal to lead this group. And then later he said, much of the world is unaware of what a powerful and dangerous force the Islamic camp is becoming. That's what he wrote in 1992, 24 years ago. And look at radical Islam today. Just like the Wall Street Journal brought out there. From the Horn of Africa, West Africa, I mean, it just stretches all across the Middle East. And these groups are competing for recruits. And they're getting a lot of them. But we were saying back in 92, much of the world's unaware of what a powerful and dangerous force the Islamic camp is becoming. Who could deny that today? Who could question that today? I mean, that was printed, 1992, I said, that was printed before any of these key players really were making much of a splash in the news at all. And now look at where we are today. It's just an average Sunday. It's all becoming so routine. That Wall Street Journal piece also said, welcome to what is becoming the new global terrorist normal. Is there any doubt that this world is in trouble? Isn't it time to face the fact that when it gets like this, where it's just an average terror Sunday, isn't it time to face the fact that these are not normal times, that this is not average? We see all these events just spiraling out of control. And what does your Bible prophesy? What does your Bible say? Well, it's we're heading along just what the Bible said that we would. Let me just play you a short audio clip of some of the protests that that turned violent there in Chicago, and that ended up canceling that rally put together by Donald Trump.
Oh my God.
That was in response to a speech. And now, obviously, Trump has gotten quite a lot of press this entire campaign season for some of the things that he's said. But still, I mean, this was arranged and funded and supported by MoveOn.org, the far-left organization. MoveOn.org raising funds from the Trump protests, it says in the Washington Times. I mean, they're going to take this to other speeches, to other rallies, backed by George Soros. This piece in the Times says MoveOn.org is conducting fundraising activities from the Chicago protests against Donald Trump that prompted the presidential frontrunner, or the Republican presidential frontrunner, to cancel a rally Friday. It says last night, this is the email they're sending out to their supporters, MoveOn.org. Last night, without consulting local police, Donald Trump abruptly canceled a rally in Chicago in the face of massive and overwhelmingly peaceful student-led protests. That's MoveOn.org's take. It was peaceful. It says, we've been flooded with aggressive emails and social media posts from Trump supporters. So now it's back and forth. And Move On says, we refuse to be intimidated by Donald Trump, Fox News, or anyone. Well, this email asks members to donate $3 to help the effort. And then the email says later, we need to double down on our work, showing that America is better than Trump's bullying, hate baiting, and incitements to violence. We're committed to nonviolence, but we will not be silent. We will not be invisible. And look, we've been given some previews already with the Occupy Wall Street movement, Black Lives Matter, the violent protests, the riots in Baltimore, in Ferguson, and elsewhere. And now, I mean, the campaign season is coming to a head. What kind of summer will this be? There's another big vote day tomorrow in the primaries. What are we looking? I mean, is that just a preview of what's to come? We've talked in the last few weeks just about how many things seem to be coming together. You think about, well, just some of the things we're going to touch on today, German elections, Brexit, the U.S. elections, the ongoing refugee crisis, the spread of radical Islam. Where will it stop? More importantly, where will it lead? Where are these things leading? This program that we had play this past weekend, again, we talked about the crisis at the close. I'll talk more on that in just a second. The crisis at the close. Bible prophecy says that world events will build to a tremendous climax of world-shaking calamities. More and more people should be waking to this fact. Paul calls this present world an evil world, Galatians 1 and verse 4. It's not that we're trying to be pessimistic or negative. It's just, what does the Bible say about the world we live in today? It's actually a very positive message. It all sets the stage for the beginning of God's kingdom, the establishment of God's kingdom on this earth. This is the message that Jesus brought to this earth. This is what Jesus spoke of in that crisis at the close message. We went right through Matthew 24. Everything Jesus said when the disciples came to him, you remember, and said, hey, what's going to happen in the last days? What will be the sign of the end of this age? And Christ went into a lot of specifics. There's a lot also in Revelation, as we covered on that program. There's a lot in the prophets. The prophet Ezekiel said, make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence. The prophet Isaiah said in chapter 1 about the country being desolate, cities burned with fire, strangers devouring the land. How much longer before people get desperate and start looking for answers? I mean, desperate in a good kind of way. You look at some of these protests and there's a lot of desperation. Fueled by grievances, fueled by hatred, fueled by division. But you look at all these things happening, and really it astounds me that there's not tens of thousands of people responding to this message or responding to thetrumpet.com or responding to my Father's Key of David program. Again, Matthew 24:3. The disciples came up to Christ. Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of this world or this age? As I was saying on that program, and I think we covered some of this on radio as well, the disciples, I mean, Christ didn't look at them and say, hey, why are you focusing on end time events? Why are you beginning to sound like doomsayers? Why are you focusing only on prophecy? We heard a lot of this from those Laodicean ministers after Herbert Armstrong died in 1986. As they came along, you remember that example when the Berlin Wall fell and that TV station in Washington State called The World Tomorrow, the program that Mr. Armstrong established, and said, hey, you've been talking about this for decades. Is this the beginning of these end time events you've been talking about? And Mr. Armstrong's successors, they said, well, no, hey, we don't want to get carried away here. We don't want to be into prophecy too much. I'm paraphrasing, but they basically said, hey, now let's not turn into doomsdayers all of a sudden. Doomsday prophets. This program, Crisis at the Close, this is the one we played at on the UK stations this past weekend. We advertised the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse booklet, and then also for the first time, He Was Right, that beautiful, beautiful booklet with Herbert Armstrong on the cover and all of those chapters, all of those sections about all of those prophecies that he discussed for so many years. It brought in 240 responses. That's a new record for The Key of David in the UK, 240. It beat the old one by 4, and there's probably going to be 10 or 15 more that trickle in this week. 250 copies of He Was Right, or 40, 240, He Was Right, and then The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. As I say, it should be tens of thousands, but perhaps that's an indication that people are, in looking around at what, you know, is just another average Sunday. 37 people get blown up here and 13 get gunned down here at a popular Western resort. And so we've just got to get used to this. As radical Islam spreads across Africa, spreads across the Middle East. And here, Germany's trying to get some kind of a deal with Turkey. The week before, by the way, we advertised America Under Attack. That's up to 143 now. Some strong booklets that we've been promoting on television in the UK. Let me just take you through a few verses. 1 Peter 4, a couple of verses here that talk about how that we have to, in looking at all that's happening, we have to be very watchful. We have to be prayerful during these trying times. We better be drawing closer to God. God says to his people, 1 Peter 4, 1 says, For as much then as Christ has suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind. For he that has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. We've got to arm ourselves with the same mind, that is Jesus Christ's mind. And then down in verse 7, he says, but the end of all things is at hand. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer. My father brings out in his booklet, the Epistles of Peter. He says that the fact that we're getting so close, that Christ's return is so near, it should really be a strong motivation to get our spiritual affairs in order, to change our behavior, to be more urgent, to cry out to God. He said the knowledge of Christ's imminent return should make us urgent spiritually. We're facing some terrifying times now just ahead of us. And most people, we know, most people won't awaken to what's happening until it actually touches their community, their street, their home, their family. But can't we have a worldview? Can't we step back and look at the widespread suffering and carnage? And then consider what is wrong. What has gone wrong with this world? Why are there so many crises? My father continued, because Christ is almost here, we must be very concerned about our prayer life. Watch unto prayer, Peter said. Carefully watch your prayer life and keep your mind on the return of Jesus Christ. You have to, or else you get discouraged. I mean, here's one presidential candidate going out there saying this, this, and this. And look, we haven't even gotten to the elections in Germany. There's politicians in Germany that are gaining in popularity that are saying just the same things as Donald Trump. And then there's the opposition. There's groups like MoveOn.org that say, hey, we're not going to be intimidated. Now, we're going to be peaceful, but we're not going to back down. You can feel it building, can't you? You certainly can. My father says, get your prayer in. Make certain you're talking to God. Get through to him every day. Get through to God every single day. We have to. We have to survive. He said later, Peter admonishes us to examine our lives to see where we can do more. The knowledge of Christ's imminent return should make us urgent spiritually. He talked about having a sense of crisis and a sense of hope. In other words, you see what's happening. You're watching unto prayer. You know it's getting near. It's even at the door. And yet you're so hopeful. You're so positive. You're so excited about the future. It's because we know it leads right into the return of Christ. I had mentioned some of the travels that I was going to get into over the weekend on Friday's program. And you get over to the small group of supporters and listeners that we have there in the Netherlands. They're tuning in. They're watching. They're listening. And they're enthusiastic in their support for God's work, for what God is doing. We just need more of them. Because the harvest, as Jesus said, is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Few. Only the few are willing to forsake all in order to serve Jesus Christ, in order to serve as a living sacrifice for God. Let me just take you through a few more verses in Luke 21, to just concentrate more directly on this point about watching world events. And having, as my father said in the Peter booklet, having that sense of crisis and that sense of hope. Jesus Christ had this. He was trying to help the disciples to have this. Luke 21 and verse 32, he says, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away until all be fulfilled." It's all coming down to the wire here. It's all happening in this present generation. In verse 34, he says, "And take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and the cares of this life, and so that that day come upon you unawares. For as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the earth." The whole earth, I should have said. That's what it says in the Bible. Everyone's going to be touched by this. All will be affected. And it's going to come upon us in a sudden, unexpected way. It shouldn't. It doesn't have to for those that have their eyes open and who are watching unto prayer. But for so many in this world, for so many people and so many nations, it's coming upon us like a snare. This is why Jesus Christ gave this warning here to his disciples. You could put this together with Matthew 24, the passage we went through on that recent program. Put it together with Luke 21. And make sure, as Christ's disciples, that we're not caught off guard, that we're prepared for what's coming, that we're ready for the return of Jesus Christ. Verse 36 says, "Watch you therefore, and pray always, that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man." That's talking about the return of Jesus Christ. And the instruction Jesus gave to the disciples, watch and pray, that you're accounted worthy to escape. You add the thoughts he had there in the previous verses. Don't get caught up in worldliness. Don't get caught up in riotous living. Don't get caught up in the cares of this present life. Don't let materialism or fleshly pursuits get in the way of your support for God's work, your dedication to God's work. Watch and pray always. Pray always. That's what Christ instructed us to do. My father made the point in that booklet, A Living Hope, the one on Peter's epistles, that Peter was in the position that he was in, chief apostle, because he was so close to God, because he really knew the Bible. That's what it boils down to for you and for me. We've got to keep our noses in the Bible and watch world events and watch them unto prayer, as Peter said there in 1 Peter chapter 4. God is evaluating. He's observing our prayer lives. He's observing how we dig into the Bible. And for those who are tuned in, I mean, you look at this world, you look at the headlines. We're really seeing some eye-popping headlines every single day. Not a weekend goes by. I mean, you can be traveling, you can be out of pocket, you can be away from the computer or the news publication. And then you come and check back in, and there they are. The world continues on its present course. There's no pause button. We're in a period of no more delay, Revelation 10 says. We're right at the crisis of the close, the Bible says. And we've got to be ready. We've got to be ready. So many prophecies are being fulfilled. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We're coming to you. If you're outside the United States, we're coming to you an hour earlier. I didn't even have a chance to tweet about that. So there's going to be a few people I know disappointed when they tune in about 29 minutes and find out that the program's over. It's staggered these next couple of weeks, at least between the United States and the UK and Europe. And so to keep with the programming schedule there in the U.S., we're going to be coming to you an hour earlier in the U.K. at noon instead of at 1. An hour earlier in Europe at 1, I guess it would be, instead of 2 o'clock. But hopefully people will catch on here in the next day or two. And of course, if you miss a program, you can always get the file or the SoundCloud file on thetrumpet.com or at kpcg.fm. This is, as I say, KPCG. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, of course, the big news yesterday coming out of Germany, the elections there. Washington Post says voters deliver a message for Germany's Angela Merkel. No more migrants. I mean, if you listen to, I thought Richard Palmer really hit the nail on the head in Friday's Trumpet Hour, where he talked about it wasn't that long ago when even we at the Trumpet would be sounding the alarm if these far-right political parties in Germany got 7, 8, maybe 9% of the vote. I mean, that in itself is huge. Just to get up to double digits would have been huge. Well, there was one region in Germany on Sunday where the Alternative for Germany party pulled in 24.4% of the vote. Nearly one-fourth. I mean, and this is the political party that's like Donald Trump on steroids. The German voters sent a message. And to this point, even though there's obviously a lot of discontent across the nations, there really hasn't been a vote for Angela Merkel's opponents to say, look, the people have spoken. You've got to revise your policies. The Post says the upstart Alternative for Germany party, a populist force that campaigned on an anti-migrant, anti-Merkel platform, which drew support from the left as well as the right, scored big gains. Big gains, a Breitbart headline says it all. The incredible shrinking Merkel. Sunday's elections could be the starting pistol for Merkel's would-be successors. Yes, the gun has sounded. And now the potential successors are off and running. Big changes in the world. Dramatic changes as world leaders grapple with all of these mounting problems. They can't figure out how to solve it. That's what George Friedman had to say about Germany. By the way, I'll get to that here in just a second. Europe is crying out for new leadership. The United States crying out for new leadership. Germany crying out for leadership in the hopes that it will solve the mounting problems. The starting pistol, it's fired away. And here come the would-be successors. The Washington Post says the outcome amounted to a blow to Merkel, just as the chancellor is set to fight this week for a new accord between the European Union and Turkey on the refugee crisis. And oh, by the way, another terrorist blast just goes off in Turkey right as they're trying to solidify this deal. This deal, the Post says, would stop the illegal flow of migrants across the Aegean Sea, but also compel reluctant European nations, including Germany, to take in more Syrian asylum seekers from Turkey. That's the plan. But now the people have spoken. Now the voters have delivered a message. And the message is no more migrants. Politico had this to say. Yes, the election loss changes the dynamic. For the first time, her own party critics can point to hard election results. They can point to this now. See? The people don't support this. The people don't want this. Politico says, though Germans are roughly split between those who support and those who oppose the chancellor's course on refugees, many in her own party are in the latter camp. It's caused deep division, even in Merkel's own party. And notice how Politico concludes. With Merkel's party already divided on the issue, it's only a matter of time before challengers emerge. It's still very unlikely she would be ousted as chancellor between now and the next round of elections, expected in the fall of 2017. But if she doesn't turn the tide in her favor soon, she may either decide or be forced by her party to forego another run. I mean, that's almost likely to be a best-case scenario. Just that she won't run in 2017. But what if something, I mean, that's still a long ways off, particularly when you look at the headlines that, as I say, we're seeing roll out every day, every weekend, every week. We saw how dramatically things shifted in Germany last year, just over the course of 3 or 4 months. What will this year hold? What will this summer be like? I mean, the weather's turning warmer. More and more of the refugees are going to be venturing out, looking at the warmer weather as an opportunity to make their run for Europe, to make the run for Turkey. It's still unlikely, it says, that she'll be ousted as chancellor between now and the next round of elections. But if she doesn't turn the tide in her favor soon, that's the thing. She's got to turn the tide soon. Or, as that previous piece brought out, the would-be challengers, they're going to be catching up to her from behind. There was this article that was translated for us at our news bureau in Edmond about Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg. And it says later on in the article, or toward the end of the article, when it got into his chances of getting back into politics. Let me just read a little bit to set the stage for it. Again and again, Gutenberg emphasized that Europe still needs to establish a place. It's just talking about how Europe needs to come to its senses, given all of the crises that it's facing. And then at the end, in spite of Gutenberg's assurance that he has no interest in a return, and despite his staging as a casual techie, speculation has multiplied lately that Gutenberg is preparing his return to German politics, especially since CSU chief Horst Seehofer invited him last autumn into his competence team. It says in the last paragraph, Gutenberg denied repeatedly. Further on, he has no interest in a comeback, it says. The expansion of his advisory and investment company fulfills him completely, he informed the newspaper in an email. He added, regardless, the legitimate reasons for my resignation and how carelessly I dealt with do not justify a return. So he's saying all the right things, sounding very humble. But when you look at what Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 say, and how he's going to come into power, and then when you look at the sentiment in Germany and the fact that they're crying out for new leaders. Well, let me get to you what Stratford had to say. This isn't actually Friedman. It's someone else writing for his company, Geopolitical Futures. But it's talking about all the troubling difficulties and crises that Germany's facing. It's been a difficult week for Germany. This was written Friday, so it's speaking of last week. This is even before the elections. But I want to say Stratford, but Friedman broke off and started a new company. It's actually Geopolitical Futures. In any event, it says, in order to preserve its security and protect its export-led economy, the country relies heavily on the EU. However, Berlin is facing a multitude of interlocking crises that are contributing to the fragmentation of Europe. This week, Germany had to contend with a series of challenges emanating from Syria, Turkey, the Balkans, Central Europe, as more worrying signs emerged about the state of its own economy. And so the problems, as I say, are mounting. And then you have elections and the people speak. Dramatic changes are coming. Let me read to you how this article concludes. This week, we saw Berlin grapple with a growing list of interrelated challenges, despite its position as the largest economy in Europe and the leading political power on the continent. Germany is finding itself unable to effectively address Europe's crises and is struggling to maintain its influence in some regions. At the same time, Germany's economic vulnerabilities are coming to the fore. We can expect many more challenging weeks for Berlin in the months ahead. That's what we can expect. I mean, and they don't know the specifics, but they know, given the number of crises they're facing, and given its own economic vulnerabilities, challenging weeks are coming. Challenging months are coming for Germany. And then meanwhile, as I said at the top, you've got Britain wrestling with what it's going to do. The June referendum, I think the 23rd, that's coming up quick. Here we are now, just, 3 months away. Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, he had a piece today that came out in strong criticism against the United States. I mean, he does introduce the piece saying he loves America, and I believe he does, but he basically is saying in this article, well, who is America to tell us that we need to submit to the European authorities? The title is, Americans would never accept EU restrictions, so why should we? He wrote an article a couple of weeks ago in which he said that he favored a Brexit or an exit from the EU for Britain. And now he's come out stronger today. Americans wouldn't submit to this. Why should we submit to it? He says the American view is very clear, whether in code or in Claire. The president will tell us all. That's talking about an upcoming visit from President Obama, who's right there in line with Mr. Cameron, urging the people of Britain to vote yes on the EU. The president, Boris says, Mr. Johnson says, will tell us all that the UK membership of the EU is right for Britain, right for Europe, and right for America. And why? Because that, or so we will be told, that's the only way we can have influence in the councils of the nations. It's an important argument and deserves to be taken seriously. I also think it is wholly fallacious. And coming from Uncle Sam, it's a piece of outrageous and exorbitant hypocrisy. In other words, who is America to tell us we should do this? Can you imagine, he asks, can you imagine the Americans submitting their democracy to the kind of regime that we have in the EU? You can't imagine something like that happening. And yet you can be sure, as Mr. Johnson says there in that piece for The Telegraph, that at some point the Obama administration will show up over here or send a strong message to the people of Britain. Stay connected. It's really the only way for you to have influence in the councils of the nations. Speaking of President Obama and his agenda in this final year of his presidency, he gave this lengthy interview, hours and hours. I think Jeffrey Goldberg sat down with him for 6 hours prior to this piece that he wrote, and of course it was built upon a number of other interviews from over the years. It was posted March 10th, and again, it's in The Atlantic, and Jeffrey Goldberg is, I think, one of President Obama's favorites. He writes very favorably about the Obama administration and about the policies of this administration. And much of what's in there is not going to come as a surprise to you. But still, it confirms a lot of the things that so many of the critics have brought out over the years. Like, for instance, the soft spot that President Obama has for despots, for dictators. He said Vladimir Putin was scrupulously polite and very frank. He had some very nice things to say about Mr. Putin, who's devouring Crimea, warring against Ukraine, calling the shots in the Middle East, propping up Bashar Assad. He's polite. He's polite. And what does Mr. Obama have to say about Prime Minister David Cameron, the British leader? He's a free rider. He's aggravated me, as has the French president. There was quite a lot of press about President Obama blaming all of the violence and the Islamic takeover of parts of Libya. He blamed that on Britain and France. And British officials and French officials, they haven't taken that lightly. They've responded with some choice words of their own for President Obama. This is from The Atlantic piece. Some of his deepest disappointments concern Middle Eastern leaders themselves. Benjamin Netanyahu is in his own category. That this is the one that really aggravates him the most. That's Jeffrey Goldberg writing. Some of President Obama's deepest disappointments concern Middle Eastern leaders themselves. Benjamin Netanyahu is in his own category. He's at the top of the list. I mean, it's more disappointing than Bashar al-Assad. It's more disappointing. He's been more of a disappointment than the Iranian mullahs, then the ISIS chief, presumably, al-Baghdadi, and on it goes. I mean, there's a special place reserved for the Israeli prime minister at the top of the list of those the president of the United States has been most disappointed with. This Atlantic piece, by the way, it refers back to the Cairo speech, June 2009, I think it was. We had a lot to say about that, by the way, at the time, and everything we said about it. It's come true in just a few short years. But it's interesting now, 6-7 years on, it's interesting to see President Obama's take on that speech. According to The Atlantic, it says, my argument was this. This is President Obama talking about his own speech at Cairo in 2009. He said, let's all stop pretending that the cause of the Middle East problems is Israel. This is what he was supposedly arguing in 2009. I was hoping that my speech could trigger a discussion, could create space for Muslims to address the real problems they're confronting, problems of governance, and the fact that some currents of Islam have not gone through a reformation that would help people adapt their religious doctrines to modernity. That's the way he sees that Cairo speech. And Michael Oren, I didn't write down where he wrote this, but he came out in response to President Obama's recollection. And he said that the Cairo speech nowhere mentions that the Israeli-Palestinian issue is not the core of the Middle East other conflicts. On the contrary, he said, it actually implied the opposite. And this is a quote from Michael Oren, his response to the Atlantic interview. It says, the Cairo speech is the foundational document of the Obama administration's Middle East policy, and it's based on linkage, that everything in the region is linked to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And therefore, if you solve it, you will solve the region's problems. It's not that hard to prove this. It's implied in the Cairo speech. It's stated directly in a number of other documents from early on, coming into office. You can probably remember yourself, people from the administration saying, if we just solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it'll solve the problems of the Middle East. And now President Obama is saying, look, when I was in Cairo, my central argument was, let's all stop pretending that the cause of the Middle East problems is Israel. It's not Israel. As if he's defending Israel. As if he was saying early on, look, if you just get your acts together, if you just get your governments right, we can all sort this out. In fact, there was a link there from the very beginning, and it was implied in the Cairo speech too, that the reason we have all of this conflict, that the reason we have all of this trouble, is because of the Israel-Palestinian division, the fact that there hasn't been a two-state solution. And so as we go forward, I mean, we can expect much, much more of this. If you have time, it's a long article. I mean, it would be worth skimming here and there. It is revealing. It is revealing. As President Obama looks back on some of the mistakes he's made, and really chief among them was that he didn't anticipate how many mistakes Britain and France and some of the others would make. That's about it. That's about it. You put that together. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, when you just contrast it with the way the Western democracies received President Obama, even before he came into office. Remember all the cheering. Remember the reception he got in Berlin. The tens of thousands of people that showed up. And what do these nations and what do their leaders think about him today as he gives this lengthy interview and talks about how polite Vladimir Putin is? How does that set with the nations of Eastern Europe? I don't think it sits well with those nations or their leaders, and certainly not when he's saying in the same piece that Mr. Cameron aggravates me, that these nations are free riders, that they're just riding on the coattails of the United States. The Bible talks about America's lovers betraying them. You can certainly see the stage being set for, again, many of the other prophecies about the double cross, about what happens when finally an invading power brings America to its knees. The Bible does prophesy this. I mean, these are not times that, again, are pleasant to discuss. But it is nevertheless what Jesus Christ spoke of, going back to that passage in Matthew 24, "For then shall be great tribulation." Everyone's going to be touched by this, all nations. We brought that out when going through Luke 21 as well. The whole world, the entirety of it. It is a lot to keep up with. But for you, if you've been listening regularly or if you visit the trumpet, I mean, it all is discussed and in such a wonderful way. Whether you listen to Friday's Trumpet Hour, as I did on the plane, I mean, you get a lot of information in a short amount of time so that you can watch unto prayer. So that you can watch and pray always, so that you can know what's coming next. You go back to that 1992 quote from my father. This was in the Trumpet magazine. This is before we had a website. He said, "It looks very much like the end-time King of the South will rule the radical Islamists." Who was talking about radical Islam in 1992? "Much of the world," he said, "is unaware of what a powerful and dangerous force the Islamic camp is becoming." Well, that's no longer the case. We're well aware, unless our heads are still just buried in the sand, but we're well aware of this threat, of just how dangerous this force is becoming. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show on KPCG, as I said, outside of the United States. We're coming to you an hour earlier for the next couple of weeks here on 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, our headquarters campus. The live stream is at thetrumpet.com and kpcg.fm. And if you miss these programs or if you know of people that may miss them, be sure to tell them that they can get it. What would it be, 4 hours later, if they want to hear it on the station, or a few hours after that when we post them on the website. Don't forget to send us your emails. Send those to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.